We're in the midst of the blessings, and we're going to just polish those off. We finished the blessings, and we're now at the end of the of Jacob's life and the gathering of Joseph and Jacob to their people. Chapter 50. Joseph flung himself upon his father's face, wept over him, and kissed him. One thing that I did not bring, and I left it on my desk to bring, and I didn't bring it, but I will, I hope, remember to bring it next time, is Jonathan Sacks writes a short piece about Joseph indicating how often Joseph weeps. At every significant moment of his life, he's crying over and over and over and over and over again. And you can see this as emotionality, or Sacks doesn't say this. This is my gloss on what Sacks is saying. You can see it as emotionality or as theatricality. I don't know. I mean, I've been at funerals, and I'm sure you have too, where you see extravagant weeping, and you don't know, or you have a sense, is that real weeping or is that theater? Because sometimes it's theater. I mean, let's be honest. It's not that people don't feel sad, but they want to display their grief, not just to feel it. But it's hard to know. I remember my first funeral ever, which I remember when I was a little kid, was my Aunt Bessie, who was my grandmother's only surviving sister. It may have been she was her only sister, and my grandmother tried to throw herself into the grave, and that people had to restrain her. Now, was she literally trying to throw herself into the grave, or was she thinking, stop me, I'm throwing now, stop me, I don't know. You know, there's no way of knowing. But this tendency of Joseph to weep is pronounced in his character, and we know that Joseph is a flamboyant character. I will only say, before I want to go on a little bit, we can come back to this, but I will only say that also flamboyance in some people is who they are. So it's not that if somebody's flamboyant, that doesn't mean that they're false, right? I think about this because I know that they're about to make a movie starring Michael Douglas, of all people, of Liberace. And those of you who remember Liberace, yeah, he was flamboyant, but he wasn't flamboyant because he was false. He was just, you know, absurdly over the top flamboyant. All right. Yes, he was like a parody of himself, but that's who he was. Then Joseph ordered the physicians in his service to embalm his father, and the physicians embalmed Israel. Now, this is a verse that's much commented on because, as you may know, embalming is not right permitted according to Jewish law. So there are several lines of interpretation. Here, for example, is another case where they take it figuratively. It didn't mean embalming like Egyptians embalmed. They just embalmed him for the journey to Israel. Or some people say that he was embalmed because that was the Egyptian practice and they didn't want to, you know. It depends which person you listen to. But nonetheless, however you understand it, it seems as though in order to preserve the corpse for the full period of mourning, they had to do some kind of preservation because they embalm him for 40 days and then the Egyptians bewail him for 70 days before they let him to go to Israel. Well, that's a long time, right? That is a long time to preserve in the ancient world. To preserve a body for a long time takes a certain artistry, and the Egyptians obviously were masters of that. The Egyptians bewailed him 70 days. Now that's that's an interesting fact. Obviously, the likeliest supposition is they're crying for him because he's Joseph's father. And it's just like when a president's parent dies, you know, all across the country you'll get condolence notes from people who, had he not been elected president, would never notice that his father died. Joseph is the viceroy of Egypt, so his father dies, so the Egyptians do what feels like fairly ritualized mourning for 70 days. And again, 70 is a very symbolic number, again, figurative. Like 40 is a symbolic number, which only means a long time. 70 is a symbolic number. It doesn't have to literally mean that they bewailed him 70 days, although it could be. When the wailing period was over, which also lets you know that there's a certain this is the wailing period, right? It's not as though people happen to be sad for 70 days, but rather 70 days is the official period in which Egyptians would bewail someone who was, I don't know, a public figure or... Joseph spoke to Pharaoh's court saying, do me this favor. And lay this appeal before Pharaoh. My father made me swear, saying, I am about to die. Be sure to bury me in the grave, which I made ready for myself in the land of Canaan. Now therefore, let me go up and bury my father, and I shall return. And Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father as he made you promise on oath. The first thing I want to point out is Joseph doesn't ask Pharaoh. Joseph, look, it says Joseph asks Pharaoh's court to ask Pharaoh. He says, please go ask Pharaoh this. And then Pharaoh responds directly, it seems, to Joseph. So a couple of commentators say this is the way it works. You go into Pharaoh's court, Pharaoh's sitting there. You don't address your appeal to Pharaoh because he's Pharaoh. What you do is you ask the people in the front row, and then he allows them to turn around and ask him, and then he addresses you, but you don't address him. So even Joseph, despite the fact that he was viceroy, couldn't say, hey, Pharaoh, or P, as he was probably known. Is it okay if I go to Canaan? He has to ask through. And I'm sure that in particular, if you're making a request, the deference is part of the, you know, if you want someone to ask you favorably, so you show them a certain respect, you're more likely to get them to agree. Tact, as Cocteau, the French author, said. He said, tact is the skill of getting yes before you ask the question. So this is, you know, Joseph has to figure out, how am I going to make sure that Pharaoh is going to agree? And one of the ways is that you... The second point is that you would assume that he understands that it's an insult to Pharaoh that Jacob doesn't want to be buried in Egypt. Because it is an insult to Pharaoh. I mean, Egypt is his place. Why doesn't Jacob want to be buried there? Yeah, he understands he has an ancestral home, but you live in Egypt now. Because remember, as far as the Egyptians were concerned, the Jews, the Israelites, let's say, staying there wasn't a prelude, right? I don't think that Pharaoh thought, oh, they'll stay here for a couple hundred years and then they'll be liberated. He thought they live in Egypt now, because there is no Israel yet. Not really, they came from there, but there's no state of Israel, there's nothing. So why does he want to go back there where there's no one except for a couple of ancestors, dead ancestors, when all of your future is here? And so what Jacob says, rather than saying, you know, this is our custom or whatever, he said, my father made me swear. And that's how Pharaoh answers him. Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father as he made you promise on oath. Since he made you promise. And remember, if you recall, when Jacob does this, Jacob says to Joseph, bury me in Canaan. Joseph says, I will. And Jacob said, swear it. And we thought there were two possibilities. One is that Jacob doesn't trust Joseph and he wants to make him swear because Joseph is a diplomatic, slippery character. The other possibility is he's preparing him for when he comes to Pharaoh, so that he will have sworn and he won't have a choice. So it won't be Joseph's fault, it will be Jacob's fault that he has to do this. Because he comes to Pharaoh and says, my dead father made me swear. It's very hard to say to someone, don't do it, right? If your dead father made you swear something. So in the end, it goes back to Jacob's merit. The Jacob, who after all is called Israel, ensures that he will be taken back. And as you'll see, I mean, we're not going to get to this for a while, but at the very end of Genesis, Joseph gets buried in Egypt, but he also has a promise, which Moses fulfills, that they will take his coffin back to Israel when they're liberated. And I'll just tell you two quick things about that, about bringing, one is, it's very beautiful that while the rest of the Israelites are collecting spoils from the Egyptians, and gold and silver and so on, before they go into the desert, what Joseph is doing, what Moses rather is doing, is looking for Joseph's coffin, right? That's his mission. That's what he cares about. And then in the Talmud, it says, because they imagine, you know, the rabbis think, what was it like to carry this coffin for 40 years through the wilderness? And what they imagine is that they carried the coffin right next to the ark that had the tablets. And when people would ask, what are those two things? The Israelites would answer, the person in this fulfilled the message in that, which is very lovely. So anyway, but that's from there's a good example. That's from the Talmud. It's not in the Torah. You will search in vain in the Torah for that story. But it's a sort of natural extrapolation of what, if they carried his coffin across the, then someone would naturally ask, you know, what's that? What is that about? Because presumably, whatever Israelites died in the desert got buried in the desert, right? They couldn't carry, you know, through 40 years, a lot of people are going to die. You can't carry them all into the land of Israel. So why this one coffin? So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the officials of Pharaoh, the senior members of the court, and all of Egypt's dignitaries, together with all of Joseph's household, his brothers, and his father's household. Only their children, their flocks, and their herds were left in the region of Goshen. Chariots, too, and horsemen went up with him. It was a very large troop. In other words, he got a royal funeral, right? You just remember presidential funerals. They have these vast motorcades and flag-draped coffin, and they go through the streets, and here the trip from Egypt to Israel also remind you that things started out very well in Egypt. I mean, this is quite something that they send all of Pharaoh's court and, you know, chariots and horses, which are military vehicles, that he gets a full state funeral all the way in Israel. So you can imagine that the Israelites felt like Egypt was going to be a wonderful, welcoming, good place for them. And this, of course, again, is something that gets repeated again and again and again through Jewish history, that places that start off good don't end up good. Not here. No, I've told you my theory about America is different. It really is. The reason America is different, I'll tell you my theory again, because I hear the snickers of skepticism. And having been brought up in an argumentative household, now I have to make my argument. The reason America is different is not because of the Constitution, and it's not because Americans are different and all of that. America is different for a very simple reason. America is different because it's heterogeneous. In all the societies where there were Christians and Jews, Frenchmen and Jews, Ukrainians and Jews, the Jews got it in the neck. The whole point about America is there's no majority. There are Hispanics and blacks and Hindus and Muslims and all different kinds of Christians, many of whom don't get along with each other at all. It's not like you have a Protestant nation and the Jews. If you had that, then America would be as dangerous as any place else. But if you think about America, the thing that makes it different from any other place is that there are too many different interest groups jostling for any single group to ever dominate. I mean, you look at the Supreme Court, right? The Supreme Court always has a few Jews on it. You think that's remarkable, but it's remarkable because Jews are a very small percentage of America, but there are other minorities that have also placed people on the Supreme Court who have the exact same consciousness of the first Hispanic judge and black judges and so on. And even when people hate Jews, like if you get, I don't know, Farrakhan on the left and Buchanan on the right, they hate each other more than they hate Jews in the middle, because there are lots and lots of different factions and interest groups and so on. So that's why, as I've said, if you right now, if I said to you, okay, you're about to be born in America, okay, you're somewhere up there wherever people are before they're born, and you have a choice. You can be born in America and you want to live a good life, and you have no previous allegiance to any ethnicity. You get to be born in America, and you can be a Hispanic, you can be an African American, you can be a Jew. What are you going to pick? You're going to pick a Jew. Because you know, right, you'd pick Persia. I didn't give you a choice. But you know that of the three, the one that actually is going to experience the least discrimination is going to be a Jew. So that's what makes America different. It's not that Americans are nicer. It's that America is a salad of all different ethnicities. And so when something bad happens, people don't go, aha, it must have been the Jew. And that's a huge difference. And we never had that in history. And that's why when people say, could it happen here? Of course it couldn't happen here, right? Because there's not a minority majority situation here. So who's going to turn on us, right? But having said that, there are other places in which it could happen, and that's worth keeping in mind. So ancient Egypt was one of them. So let's just do the burial. When they came to Goren Ha'atad, which is beyond the Jordan, which is usually translated as the threshing floor, they held there a very great and solemn lamentation. And he observed a mourning period of 7 days for his father. Now, of course, this is not according to Jewish law, because according to Jewish law, Shiva begins, when the funeral begins. But the funeral can't begin, according to Jewish law, 110 days later. I suppose you could make the case that he didn't have a choice because of the Egyptians and the journey and so on, but nonetheless. And when the Canaanite inhabitants of the land saw the mourning at Goren Ha'atad, they said, this is a solemn mourning on the part of the Egyptians. That's why it was named Evel Mitzrayim, which means the mourning of Egypt, or the Egyptians, which is beyond the Jordan. This is a place name, apparently, Evel Mitzrayim, and this is the story that explains the name of the place. Thus his sons did for him as he had instructed them. His sons carried him to the land of Canaan, buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah, the field near Mamre, which Abraham had bought for a burial site from Ephron the Hittite. After burying his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. So the irony of the first place in Israel that Jews own being a burial site, which is the first place that Jews own, because that's what Abraham buys from Ephron, it's now done. It's now sealed. That is, no one else is going to be buried in Ma'arat HaMachpelah. Joseph doesn't end up buried there. These are the four fathers and four mothers that are buried in the cave, and it will be sort of the anchor that Israel will return to, that this is where their ancestors bought the land, where Abraham bought the land, and where they are buried. Now, I just want to say, because someone sent me yesterday, in fact, a very beautiful short film, an 8-minute film of the grave of Mordechai and Esther in Iran, that they made of the inside of it. And it was really very lovely, with music by David Broza, a nice film, actually made by a non-Jew, non-Jewish Persian. I want to say about that and about Ma'arat HaMachpelah that we can't know. You can't know if the sites that we have are the sites or they're not the sites, right? Burial caves that go back thousands of years are by their very nature speculative, right? You have no idea what the continuity of those are, and all the structures around them were built long, long, long after the graves were. Having said that, though, the pull, as we've mentioned before, the pull of a place where your ancestors are buried is very powerful, especially if all the ancestors, and except for Rachel, it's all of them, it's Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rebecca, and Leah, especially if they're all buried in that one place. And so the Jacob's idea, and I think it was true, is that there's a certain gravitational pull that will remind you that that's really your place, that place where everybody's buried. And you do feel that in some ways when you go to Israel now, and you see the graves on the Mount of Olives. It's like, okay, I understand that there are Jewish cemeteries all over the world, but actually this is where Jews get buried, right? And there's something to that, which is one of the reasons why people feel they want to be buried in the land of Israel. All right, let's stop there and take questions or comments, yeah.
Well, you said with curiosity that the faith in Israel and Egypt embalmed
I'm sure it has. I'm not aware of it, although in theory you could write that Israel got frozen in some sense in Egypt until they were liberated. I have no doubt that somebody's made that sort of comment about it, but I don't think that I've run across it, at least I don't remember it. It's a little bit of an inversion because presumably they're doing him a favor, but yeah, you could certainly see it that way, that Egypt actually stunted Israel's development until it was time for them to be liberated. So, other, yes?
Or Egypt preserved Israel in a time when they would
have
perished.
Or that Egypt preserved Israel in a time where they would have perished. You could certainly see it that way. I mean, look, the debate about whether persecution has made a contribution to the survival of the Jewish people is an interesting and fraught debate. I mean, I would like to think that we would have survived even if people didn't try to kill us. But there's no doubt that crisis and persecution creates a certain solidarity. The only thing that I always say when people say that the reason that the Jews survived is because they were persecuted is that there are lots of peoples in history that have been persecuted and most of them aren't here. So obviously persecution doesn't assure your survival, or every people that were persecuted would be here, and in fact most of them are not here. So there's got to be more of an element to it than that. Nonetheless, having said that, it is certainly true. I mean, look, if you want tomorrow we remember this from innumerable crises in Jewish history, like the 67 war, right? If you want tomorrow for the Jewish community to mobilize, all you have to do is create some existential threat. And there will be a surprising degree of Jewish solidarity and mobilization. We all know this. Yeah.
Right. Understand it. So I think the cultural aspect, and we have to remember that the culture here is, at least it's Middle Eastern, Egyptian, and throughout the Bible, and part
right.
of emotion. So I think the elevation or the disdain of emotion is actually, for me, a European or a development of another thing. And the same way, what we're talking about embalming, I think it's very important that we came from Babylonia and Egypt in terms of the forge where our culture was forged. We were forged through two very different ancient civilizations, and they had a huge impact on who we became.
Yes.
I think that the preservation isn't just persecution, but also contact with very deep ancient cultures in which we gleaned certain parts of it and threw out other parts and then become us. So.
Right, absolutely, and that's been true throughout Jewish history. There's no question about it. Gerson Cohen, who was a historian at the Jewish Theological Seminary, was the chancellor for a while, wrote an essay called The Blessings of Assimilation, in which he talks about what Jews got from different cultures. And he starts with the Bible, and he says, the essay, which is really, I'll give you a quick summary of the essay, because it's really an amazing thing that he does. There's a midrash that asks, why did the Jews deserve to survive Egypt? And the answer that the Midrash gives, this is the rabbis, right, a long time ago, they said because they didn't change their names, they didn't change their language, and they didn't change the way they dressed. In other words, they preserved their Jewish identity in Egypt, okay? So Cohen, who is a historian, who was a brilliant historian, who was sadly had a disease in his last several years and died too young, but he says the truth is that all three of those things are exactly the opposite. He said, let's start with names. First of all, in the Bible itself, Moses is an Egyptian name. Aaron is an Egyptian name. Pinchas is an Egyptian name. Chofni is an Egyptian name. Then he leaps to the Talmud. He says, you go to the Talmud and you get Rabbi Alexandri. Does that sound like a Hebrew name to you? And he got Rabbi Aristobulus, Rabbi Yishmael, right? That's not, none of, he says there are a lot of rabbis that have, even Akiba, we think of it as a Hebrew name, but Akiba sounds more Greek than Hebrew. So he says, first of all, so that's not true about the names. He said about language, we know that Jews have been creative in every language. He said, you know, Yiddish, Ladino. He said they've created Jewish languages, but even those are hybrids of other languages. He said it's not true that Jews spoke Hebrew for most of their history. For most of their history, Jews spoke whatever language they spoke. Even in Babylonia, you had what was called a Meturgaman. In Babylonia, in the time of the rabbis, this may make you feel better, when they would read the Torah, there would be someone who would stand there and translate it into Aramaic because they didn't understand the Hebrew. So you have ancient Aramaic translations of the Torah because just like you sit there and you read the English, they would sit there and they would hear the Aramaic. So the idea that they didn't change their language is, I mean, some of the Bible is also in Aramaic, which we think of as very close to Hebrew, but Steinsaltz, the Israeli scholar Steinsaltz, spent a good part of his life translating the Talmud into Hebrew so that modern Israelis could read the Talmud, because they don't read Aramaic. So even though it looks the same and it sounds the same, believe me, having had to learn it to learn Talmud, you can know Hebrew and it doesn't help you. It helps, but. And in terms of dress, he talks about all the ways that Jews have dressed for most of their history. So for example, when you say the blessing, Oter Yisrael B'tif Ara, in the morning blessings, when you did that, you were supposed to, which means who crowns Israel with glory. All the morning blessings, you were supposed to do certain things. Who lifts up the bent, you were supposed to, that was when you stand up. Who gives eyes to the blind, that was when you first opened your eyes in the morning. So Cohen says, what did you do when you said who crowns Israel with glory? That's when you wound your turban around your head. Because in the time of Maimonides, you wore a turban. And the wearing of a kippah, by the way, is a later development. And it wasn't really until the later Middle Ages that Jews ever thought about wearing a kippah all the time. Not at all. In the Talmud, nobody wears a kippah all the time. And even in the 20th century, German Jews, for example, didn't wear, even very, very traditional ones, they wouldn't wear a kippah all the time. My father remembers Louis Ginsberg, the great scholar of Midrash, would sit there, he'd put a kippah on his head, he would say the blessing over the bread, he would take it off, he'd eat, he'd put it back on, and say the Birkat HaMazon, right? Because when you said a blessing, you would wear a kippah. But there was no reason to wear a kippah, as there is not now all the time. Do you know why people, there's only one Jewish legal principle, there's been a lot of essays written about this, that tells people why they should wear a kippah all the time. And it is b'chukotehem lo telechu. You should not walk in their ways. That is, so that people know you're Jewish. That's the only reason to wear a kippah. Not because there's any prescription in Jewish law that says you have to, but because otherwise it's like you're hiding. Right. So what Cohen says is, exactly as you said, not only from Egypt and Babylonia, although primarily in ancient times, but from every civilization that Jews have passed through, we've taken as well as given. When you light a Yahrzeit candle, listen to the word Yahrzeit. Does that sound Hebrew to you? It's German. It was a medieval German custom, but then it became a Jewish custom, right? A lot of the Passover Seder we know was taken from the Greek Symposium. We always absorbed, as every culture does. The advantage that Judaism has of other cultures, though, is that ours is so old that we've absorbed things that don't exist in other cultures anymore, so people think of them as Jewish, right? So, for example, when you talk about the Sabbath, well, we based it on the Babylonian, and that's a Babylonian word originally, by the way. We don't know exactly what the Babylonian practice was, but clearly there was some symbiosis between our Sabbath and the Babylonian one, but there are no Babylonians around to cry copyright infringement. So we get the Sabbath. But that's how any living culture continues to exist. Just walk into the sanctuary. You know, in ancient times, the rabbi and the cantor and the Torah were never in front of the kahal. They were in the center. They were in the center. But Jews passed through all these churches where they were put in front. And so when even you go to very, very, very traditional synagogues sometimes, it's now in front. And it just, look at the way Hasidim dress. Where is that dress from? That long black coat. It's 18th century Polish noblemen dressed that way. There's nothing Jewish about it whatsoever, although there is now, right? Now there is. In fact, I have a friend of mine, whom many of you know, Danny Gordis, told me once he was walking to synagogue in the valley when he lived in North Hollywood. And he's walking next to a friend of his who was a chassid. And it was the summer, and it was 100 some degrees out. And And his friend turned to him and said, because the Baal Shem Tov, who was the founder of Hasidism, was born in the Carpathian Mountains, I have to schwitz, right? So that idea that we, you know, schwitz is sweat, Yiddish for sweat. So that idea that we created this culture that was frozen and nothing ever touches it and so on, it's, you know, it's ridiculous. And also it's not nearly as interesting or as creative as being able to take from other cultures things that suit you and rejecting the things that don't suit you, which is how we've survived.
I can't help but say that your notion of that we survive because of pluralism, which I think is wonderful, sort of puts it to theocracy, doesn't it? Theocracy
yes.
would not be a...
Theocracy is bad for the Jews.
Very
bad for the Jews.
And
yep.
that we continue to talk about theocracy and to describe it and embolden it in our history.
Yep.
It makes no sense anymore, it seems to me.
Well, let me put it this way. First of all, there never really was a pure theocracy that's ruled by God in the Jewish state, because there was always a political wing and a priestly wing, right? David was no priest. He was the king. So there always was a political arm. In the modern world, I think one thing that we've discovered again and again and again, and we see it now in Israel, is that the alliance of religion and government is combustible and dangerous. And you see it throughout the Muslim world. And you certainly saw it in Europe before the Enlightenment. And you see it now in Israel, the extent to which ultra-Orthodox parties have political power as opposed to religious persuasion is the extent to which religion strangely is stifled as opposed to liberated. In America, one of the reasons why America is much more religious than any European country is because we never had an established church. So as a result, other religions could flourish because it didn't have to be this or nothing, but in Europe it did, and religion got strangled in its crib, so to speak. They were very smart people. Well, as Wieseltier said on Tuesday, he said it was also very fortunate that America was founded during those 20 minutes of history, as he put it, where deism, which means that God is real but God doesn't intervene, was a very powerful current in thought. So Jefferson was a deist, and I think Washington was sort of a deist. Franklin was probably a deist. In other words, they believed in God, but God stayed out of their business, basically. And so that allowed you to create a republic where you were open to religion and open to God, but you didn't say, this is the way you have to. You know, Jefferson created his own New Testament. You know this, where he and now it's available, it's published, where with the scissors and paste, he cut out all the sayings of Jesus that he thought Jesus couldn't really have said, because they were inconsistent with his understanding of the person that Jesus was. And it's called the Jefferson Bible. And you can buy it and you can read what Jefferson thinks Jesus really said as opposed to what the New Testament says Jesus said. So, but that kind of openness in both senses to religion, that is, he both thought that religion was important enough to do that and also thought that religion hadn't gotten it completely right, allowed this flourishing that otherwise wouldn't be. Yeah. Well, remember that the children are kept in Egypt. So the first point is maybe Pharaoh knew that they might not stay, and so that he leaves they all go, but the kids stay in Egypt. So they had to come back. So let's say, was that entirely Pharaoh's choice? My guess is also that their life was good in Egypt, and they didn't have, you know, remember they came there because of the famine. Joseph was a very powerful protector, and that's another thing that has happened throughout Jewish history, is when Jews live well outside of Israel, they tend to be content to live outside of Israel. Look at us. So for the brothers too, they were living well in Egypt. Although if you want to take it up one level, one theological level, it's also part of God's plan. God wants them back in Egypt because you have to go through the slavery and then the liberation and so on. So from a lot of different points of view, yeah.
I see and hear
didn't approach Pharaoh directly. It said that because a mourner regarded as unclean was not permitted in the presence of Pharaoh. And
possible.
That made me wonder about the whole process of, or the whole rule of thumb about being clean or unclean if you're a mourner. I know the custom of washing your hands outside of
right.
home on the day of the funeral.
So, okay.
Does that mean that the house it will then be clean? Is the mourner unclean for 7 days, 30 days?
Well, the. It's not, here's the, there are very, very elaborate laws of Jewish purity, of which we only participate in a small percentage, like the mikveh is, you know, menstruation and the mikveh is one part of Jewish purity. I'll tell you what's so funny. I thought of another story about my father. Another thing that makes someone impure, by the way, is having what I would call, if I were being really clinical, a nocturnal emission. In other words, if a man ejaculates at night, has a wet dream, okay, that also makes you impure. So I remember when my father hired the first female rabbi who graduated from the seminary, and as his assistant, Amy Eilberg. And I remember he would not let us go to the meeting in which this was discussed because he said it's going to get, because there are a lot of very traditional people in the synagogue, and he said it could get personal. Turned out not to, from what I understand, but it could get personal and it could get ugly, and he didn't want us to go to the meeting. It was the only synagogue meeting I ever wanted to go to. But about 10 people told me the following story the next day, which I later confirmed with him, although I knew it was true because it sounded just like my father. Someone said, okay, Rabbi, I'm willing to have a female rabbi come, but I'm not willing to have her touch the Torah unless we make sure that she's going to the mikveh after she's menstruated. And my father said, agreed, as long as we make sure that every man who touches the Torah has not had a nocturnal emission the night before. So that's what I was thinking of, about the laws of purity. He was something. So there are these very elaborate laws of purity of which only a small number are observed today, like the mikveh and the washing hands when you leave a cemetery, or washing before you walk in to the house of Shiva. And that's because in the laws of purity, the what's called av tuma, which means the father of impurity, in other words, the greatest source of impurity is a dead body. And that's why Joseph has been in the presence of a dead body, and that's why he's impure. That's the avtuma, there are lots of explanations. My favorite is the one that Samson Raphael Hirsch gives. He says that when you see a dead body, it might tempt you to believe that human beings are only physical. And that's why it's the most impure thing, is that you'll treat it just as a purely physical thing as opposed to a spiritual. But whatever the reason, and you can think of many other reasons, obviously, why death has all sorts of taboos around it, always has, and probably always will. Anyway, so if you're in a house of mourning, there is impurity, and the very small symbolic thing that's left is washing your hands before or after you go into a Shiva house as you leave the cemetery, and it's why a Kohen can't go into the presence of a dead body, because a Kohen has to be ready for service in the temple if the Mashiach comes tomorrow and the temple's rebuilt. And in order to do that, they have to be pure, and if they go in the presence of a dead body, they're impure. So anyway, that's the purity thing. It's a very, in the Talmud, very, very elaborate laws of purity, but most of them are irrelevant now because there's no temple. And purity really, really has to do with service in the temple more than anything else. But other, yeah. Don't know. It doesn't say. I guess I don't know how many years. You'd have to figure out how many years he was in Egypt. But presumably, because how many years does it say that he lived in? I'm guessing yes, but I don't know. And also, even if the famine is over in general, it doesn't mean that Canaan is doing anywhere near as well. Think of the after effects of such a famine, doing nearly as well as Egypt. is. It still takes, you know, when you come out of a depression, it takes a long time before you're back on your feet. So, yeah.
Doesn't it say somewhere that Jacob lived 17 years in Egypt?
Yes, I think so.
Seven
well, no, the famine lasts, right, seven. There are 7 years of plenty, and then there are 7 years of, right, fallow. So I don't know at what point during the famine he came. So, yeah, he probably long outlasted the famine. Yeah, that makes sense.
I was thinking about the discussion earlier about the theocracy versus not theocracy,
yeah,
and whether we have a kingdom,
right,
or not. And I've been thinking about this since you've been talking about studying David. And I don't know much about it, but there was a period of time in which there was a controversy in Israel about whether to have a kingdom or whether to,
mm-hmm,
whether,
right,
the priests were, whether a king is,
yes,
what God wants or just what the people,
right,
need.
Well, so yeah, this is it's discussed in Deuteronomy, and really it's talked about in the book of Samuel. If we do the whole book of Samuel, we would get into it. By the time you come to David, it's a moot point. So I what I was thinking of doing was the first, as I said, the first 10, 12 chapters of Exodus, just so we get to do the plagues and Moses and so on, and then skipping over to Robert Alter's book, which is called The Story of David, which is really just the story of David. And we might be able, what we could probably do is retroactively go over the king argument, because it's actually a really interesting argument, and in some ways was revived even in the Middle Ages. But there is, yeah, there's a constant tension in the Torah between kingship and God's rule, a constant tension. Because if God is ruling you, what do you need a king for? But the people want a king. They want a king for all the reasons that people want a leader. And I mean, it may be that the people's instinct here was sound. God finally gives into it, so maybe they were right, that it's not good to just be ruled by priests. I mean, can you imagine ruled by rabbis would not be a good thing. So anyway.
The American experiment in theocracy,
yeah,
has shown us historically why it's so dangerous.
Right.
It wasn't carried, and yeah, the founders all knew that.
Yeah.
They knew it happened in Massachusetts.
Right, exactly. Yep.
Joseph was the great grandson of Abraham, am I right?
Yes.
So it seems that from Abraham to Joseph, there was a big culture that started with Abraham to Joseph to make Jews or Hebrews.
Tricky. I mean, I don't know what that means, the culture. It doesn't explicitly say in the Torah what Abraham transmitted. If you listen to the rabbis say, yeah, he transmitted everything to him, but the Torah gives very few details about what that culture means. But it sounds to me like you're moving on to something else. So go ahead. Well, that's the question. Well, there's no way of knowing. The question is, did Hebrews have an established culture by the time Joseph came there, or were they just a separate tribe from Canaan? Look, if you just read the Torah, the culture really is created by the giving of the Torah. We don't get much in the way of culture before that. We get a little bit, but not much. You see a few points, but if you actually list them on a piece of paper, not nearly as much as might be. I mean, it doesn't say, for example, it says they mourned for 7 days, it doesn't say how they mourned, and there are lots of contradictions to it too. Why is it that Abraham goes out and feeds, you know, milk and meat why is it that they can allow him to be embalmed? Why is it that they wait 110 days to do the service? All those kinds of things. So it's not clear, and this is, the rabbis go back and sanitize it so that everything fits with Jewish law. But if you just read the Torah on its own, it's not clear to us how much of Jewish culture is there and how much of it develops later. It's a strange thing in a way, because you understand the rabbinic impulse is to believe that they couldn't possibly observe more Jewish law than Abraham did. So they have to find, they assume in Abraham's life that he observed everything. But if Abraham really observed everything, then what's the point of giving the Torah? Because you've already got everything. What do you need the Torah for? Abraham already knows everything. So they're caught in this sort of contradiction between wanting the ancestors to be more pious than they are, but realizing that the ancestors couldn't possibly have had all the stuff that they have, because they have not only the Torah, giving of the Torah, but the development then of rabbinic culture of the last many hundreds of years, none of which was available to Abraham or Isaac. So it depends. It depends how you see that rabbinic view of. And when I say rabbinic view, by the way, and when I say the rabbis, I'm always talking about the rabbis of the Talmud. So I mean the rabbis after the end of the Bible until about the 6th or 7th century, and those who follow them after, but mainly the rabbis of the Talmud. And for them, the ancestors had to be at least as pious as they were. But you don't get that much of it from the Torah. So we have time for one more, if there is one more. Other question, comments? Yes?
The Torah makes the ancestors very human.
Yes.
With lots of fallacies and mistakes. So I don't see how you can think of them as more pious than we are.
Well, read the rabbis' comments on it and you will. The rabbis don't see them on our level, or even close to our level. And the rabbinic commentary on it vastly elaborates their goodness, their piety, all of those sorts of things. And also, even in the Torah, we don't have God speaking to us directly the way they did. And we don't have angels coming down and wrestling with us the way they did. So we're the first generation. And by the generation, I don't mean the last 10 years. I mean the last probably 100 years. The first generation that delighted in the humanness of the Torah characters as opposed to their greatness. So most of Jewish history was much more concerned to find their greatness than to find their brokenness. These days it's fashionable to go for the brokenness, but that's, you know, we have to realize that that's not the way most of Jewish history read these people. It would rather explain their flaws away and exaggerate their good qualities than do what we tend to do, which is take comfort in their flaws. And so it's a different orientation. If you ever want to read a difficult, but an extraordinarily brilliant and suggestive book about the way that culture shifts, you can read Philip Reif's book, The Triumph of the Therapeutic. Reif's, I will now give to you in 2 seconds what is a complete betrayal of a brilliant book, because you can't really explain a brilliant book in 2 seconds. But what Reif says, Reif was one of Freud's leading interpreters. He was a sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania. And he wrote this book called The Triumph of the Therapeutic, which is like off the charts brilliant book. And what he says is that the culture changed radically when it moved from good and bad to healthy and unhealthy. And that when we talk about human beings in therapeutic terms, that's very different from talking about human beings in moral terms. And we don't discuss people the way that our ancestors discussed people, because we see that, and this love of brokenness is a good example. That would not have resonated with somebody in the 15th century, because they saw people very differently. And the reason he calls it the triumph of the therapeutic is because the therapeutic mindset, and he's an interpreter of Freud, he's already talking, this was written, I think, in the 50s, although it could be the 60s. The therapeutic mindset has triumphed, so we don't see it anymore. I'll tell you one last story about Reif. So, as I say, he was a sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania. My father took some courses with him and decided he would bring him to the synagogue. And if you think Wieseltier was hard to understand, Reif was impossible. He was impossible. He was the son of a kosher butcher from Chicago, but he spoke with an English accent. honest to God, that's really true. All you need to know for this story is that the poet John Keats was one of the great romantic poets of the English tradition, okay? Keats. So Reif had to, I don't think that Reif drove. right? He probably never drove a car in his life. So when he finished speaking to the synagogue and completely confused them, so my father asked if I would take him back to Penn, and I said, great, I get to spend, you know, a half hour in the car with Reef and ask him all the questions I want to ask him. So we get into the car, and he asks me, honestly, in a very like snooty English accent, I wish I could imitate it, but you'll have to imagine. He says, so what do you want to do with your life? And I was, at the time, I think I was probably a junior in college or something, so I was 20. I said, I want to be a writer. I said, but I just read The Naked and the Dead by Norman Mailer, and he wrote that when he was 26, I think. I said, and I have to tell you, I despaired, you know, when I read that, when he wrote that in 26. So I'll never forget it. He said to me, Keats died at 25. Is that an aspiration of yours as well? Oh, he was a kick. All right, please rise.